Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another episode of the NIDS View, where we discuss the topics of the day. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Chris Stewart. Jim Petrosky is off this week, but we're going to talk about an exciting topic, I think, something hopefully you, the listeners, will enjoy. So there was an article that came out on Thursday of last week. That was an article penned by Curtis McGiffin and myself in War on the Rocks called America Needs a Dead Hand More Than Ever. And it was a follow-on to our 2019 article, America Needs a Dead Hand. And in the 5 years since we wrote that original article, we've been cited a number of times in books and articles, mostly with great derision and what are these guys thinking? These guys are crazy, and we just want to make sure you know that they're crazy. But over the last 5 years, we've seen a lot change. The Russians invaded Ukraine. The Russians have made numerous nuclear threats. They've, suspended New START. The Chinese have broken out and are, likely to build a nuclear arsenal that exceeds our own. The North Koreans have said that they're going to have at least 500 nuclear weapons. And so it's a different world than it was in 2019. It was peaceful back then. It's not anymore. And so our article was a follow-on to that, and we wanted to go into more detail than we did in the original piece. The original piece, we said, hey, here's the problem. We have this attack time compression problem where new weapons like hypersonics and low observable cruise missiles make it harder and harder to have, warning before you're going to see a weapon coming. And so we have to be able to respond faster. That was kind of our original article or argument. And then now there's so much more has happened. And so we wanted to follow up and we wanted to offer more specific detail about what an AI system or an AI enabled system might look like and what it isn't. And then we talked about the fundamental challenge of presidential decision-making once nuclear weapons start flying. And so with that, let me turn it over to you, Curtis. So as we try to describe this article for, our listeners, what do you think they really need to understand and know?
Well, thanks, Adam. I really enjoyed writing the article with you. And I will say that the 2019 article, America Needs a Dead Hand, I think was the first one you and I wrote together. And it is, just been a memorable piece that has been read by many, as you've mentioned, most of the time and with some sort of disdain. But I think a lot of our predictions in 2019 have come out. We spent a lot of time in that article, which is on War on the Rocks, by the way, sort of describing the nature of the threat. But some of it hadn't really happened yet. It was sort of, we knew it was coming. Well, since then, and something else that has occurred in the 5 years since we wrote that, right? Russia has actually deployed hypersonic glide vehicles. They've shown them to us under the New START Treaty. So we know they're there. So all of that attack time compression that we discussed in the first article is, in fact, exists. And it isn't just, how close they might be off the east or west coasts and shooting at us to hit critical infrastructure or decapitate leadership. It is real ballistic missile vectors that I think are going to provide challenges to us. We've also had this new risk of FOBs, yes. And the idea from China, which is old Russian idea and technology, this fractional orbital bombardment capability, where a lot of this would come from the south. And I believe there's some talk of some of the Russian systems, the Sarmat and others, having enough range that they can attack from the southerly orbit, if you will, or if their nuclear-powered cruise missile that's supposed to fly forever sort of thing ever happens. And when you have a legacy system that is only looking north, and reasonably out into the oceans, looking for those sub-launched capabilities, we tend to forget about the other stuff. And for a while, the government, tried to address this cruise missile threat with the JLENS program, right? The dirigibles that we had on the East Coast with some radar systems, so we looked down, and then one kind of got away, and it had to be downed, and it was embarrassing. And so, you know, we did what we normally do as the federal government: we sort of destroy and and remove a great program because it had a faux pas such. Rather than trying to make it better and safer, we just sort of eliminate it, and now we still have, I think, I could be wrong, but I think there's still some sort of gap there. I haven't seen anything replace it, and so all of these things sort of, I think, give affirmation to what we wrote about 5 years ago, in that the attack time compression exists, and that attack time compression is the fact that these technologies have proliferated and grown in capability such that it is continuing to shrink the decision making time, right, of what we would do in a war, right? In the 50s, we had 4 hours of warning because it was just bombers coming across the Canadian frontier, right? And then in the 60s with the ICBM, it kind of shrunk down to 30 minutes, which was a huge change. Then with the submarine launch ballistic missile, and later in the 60s, it got down even smaller. And now what we're arguing here is, when you look at hypersonics and close-in systems coming from the sea or the air, you may be looking at time that is less than the ability for any sort of efficient gonculation to occur for the president to make an informed decision. We think that's a problem. And we think that is something that negatively affects deterrence, because if in the end the adversary believes that a first strike can in fact win, then it becomes provocative, right? And that's, most of our definitions of strategic stability are based around the understanding that neither side has an incentive to go first. And I think when we don't have a good NC3 and a good capability to defeat the attack time compression, we then cede that opportunity to the adversary and perhaps encourage them to go first.
Chris, you had a chance to take a look at the piece, and it was, you know, take an outside look. Curtis and I have been looking at this for 5 years. And so from an outside perspective, what was your take?
Well, it was a couple different things. One is, I thought it was, just for you gentlemen, I thought it was really well written, really well reasoned, and really well informed. And, you know, I have some background in this, as you know, you know, and your listeners may know, your viewers. I was an Air Force pilot. I flew combat rescue helicopters, but I also flew the B-1. And I've sat on that aircraft, not in the air, but on the ground, with you know, two bomb bays full of nuclear weapons. You know, it really is, it's almost a surreal experience to open the bomb bay doors and look at these weapons. And, you know, the B-1 didn't carry tactical weapons, at least, you know, not at the time. They wore real crowd pleasers. These were enormous, enormous weapons. And it was a little bit sobering. And do I consider myself a nuclear expert like you two? No, I don't. Do I consider myself relatively well-informed? I do. And then, you know, the time I spent in Congress on the Intel and also on appropriations on defense, I think informed me as well. So a couple observations. One, to your point, Curtis, about, you know, compressing, the continued compression of time that the president or national command authority has to respond to a first strike, or what they think is a first strike, is absolutely the key, I think, to your article and the arguments for integrating more and more technology into this, including artificial intelligence, that would allow us to have really good information, or at least the best possible information, and to have that information more quickly. That's what we're trying to do. I think that's the priority. Now, we can talk about the dead man switch and others, and we should, because I think that's an integral part of the conversation as well. But for some people who have, and I have to say, when it comes to public policy and defense policy, this is an example, and there's maybe not another better example. Well, maybe nuclear power with Three Mile Island and, the Jane Fonda movie, which really kind of set the tone of American response to nuclear power. I mean, that movie had enormous impact on our society and those who reject nuclear power. And I think the same thing's true of this idea of having any automation or any artificial intelligence in the nuclear command decision process because of Hollywood and the various movies, and some of them quite well known about, this thing's going to take over and it's going to take people out of the decision making and it's just going to have the machine do it. I know that's not your intention. It's not the intention of policy and decision makers who are advocating for this. Again, it's two things in my view of reading your article and my own background. Allowing more time, allowing the president to have more time to actually understand what the threat is, make sure that it's real, because there has been examples where we thought we were actually under nuclear attack and it turned out it wasn't true, and then to make a better decision as to the scope of that attack and the best way to respond. I don't know how anyone could argue against that. Again, this idea that, artificial intelligence is going to, disassociate humans from the decision process, not what we want to do. Having said that, last thing, I got to tell you, I'm probably a little more uncomfortable than you two are with the next step, and that would be to have pre-programmed or the president have pre-decisions made as to various scenarios that would be undertaken if he were not available, if he were incapacitated. I think that's worth a lot of further discussion.
I think that's great. Adam, tell us about what we meant by that.
Well, so, the concern that we had is, for the case of the United States specifically, the president really has no involvement in, exercising, wargaming, practicing his role as the commander-in-chief who a presidential decision conference is called. He's trying to get to a safe place, and the STRATCOM commander comes up, and he's got the SecDef, and then he's presented with options to respond to an inbound attack. That's going to take place, as we point out, in a, single digit minutes. And the president, who's doing this for the first time, is, he's at an information disadvantage. And he's got two of his senior advisors saying, "Sir, what do you want to do?" And the president, I would dread being in that position. And part of what we wanted to do was make this a better process. And so by making it a better process, what we thought was, STRATCOM plans has lots and lots of scenarios and lots of things they plan for. And the idea was that in a time of peace, that you bring those senior advisors to the White House, you sit down with the president and you say, "Mr. President, we think these are the things that could happen. Here's some possible scenarios." And you walk through them, you talk to the president, and the president says, "In this scenario, I think I would want to do this." And you go through all those scenarios, and this is probably a weeks-long process. Maybe it's a day here, a day there. And eventually you get through the scenarios for each of the major countries. And then you can program those. You program those into the actual system such that when, let's suppose, the system's in manual and there's a detection of an inbound strike and that inbound strike has been verified. We have dual phenomenology. We have both hard coding and we have algorithms that have vetted the data and said, "Yep, there's an inbound strike." And then what the system can do is the system can present back to the president, "Hey, Mr. President, Whenever you sat down without all the stress and strain of, you know, less than 10 minutes to make a decision about an inbound strike, here's what you said you would want to do in that scenario. And then the president can say, you know what? I do think that's what I want to do. Or the president can say, you know what? That's not what I want to do. I want to do something different. But the president will know what he thought in time of peace, and then he can make a more informed decision, as opposed to having the SecDef and the STRATCOM commander saying, Mr. President, here's what we suggest. What do you want to do? We've got, you know, X number of minutes to make this decision, and you need to get to safety. Because that's a recipe that I don't think is an optimal recipe. Now, if the system's on automatic, which, you know, that's an escalation tool, is to say, hey, the system's on automatic. If you try to take out, you know, the president, because one of the things, what do we tend to want to do? We tend to want to make our adversaries deaf, dumb, and blind. And so the expectation should be that we want to do the same thing to them. But we can warn off our adversaries by saying, hey, listen, if you make us deaf, dumb, and blind, and the system's in automatic, then it's going to automatically respond. And so you can hopefully de-escalate a conflict. And then if all else fails, the system can match the president's, his pre-selected option for, you know, it'll detect what's inbound and it'll verify what's inbound. And then it'll say, okay, this is what we know is inbound. The president said that if we detect this, you know, strike package, then here's the way we're supposed to respond. And so it's not artificial intelligence. It's not a general AI saying, okay, here's what I think. Here's the decision I make. It matches what it detects with what the president said he wanted. And then, of course, the system is, you know, it's not general intelligence. It's algorithms embedded. You know, there's multiple layers. So you're not just depending upon one algorithm. You're going to have, and we talk about the various tools and the ways you would vet it. And so that's how the system would work. And we think that's a better system than we currently have. So that was sort of our thought. Did you want to add anything to that, Curtis?
Let me add just something, a couple things here that aren't actually in the article, but I think add some context here. And that is that, for whatever reason, you know, our senior leaders don't normally practice this. It's not something they do, at least out in the open, if at all. Their assistants and assistants to assistants will sometimes, you know, play in these exercises and these sorts of things on the rare occasion that they might occur. But I'll tell you that the Russians, for example, have exercises several times a year, at least what's reported by Moscow, and Putin participates. I suspect that Putin has practiced making decisions on both going first and retaliating against the United States several times a year. This is not a decision that's going to be foreign to him. He will have rehearsed this. Well, how long has he been in power now? 24 years, going on another six. So he will have rehearsed this a lot. And so the pressure on him, I think at least psychologically, will be much less because he's thought through this and he's gone through it through the stress of actually participating in exercises. And so this is a tool that can also sort of cover down not only for the POTUS, but on the secession efforts, right? And who's going to fall in next in the secession plan? They have to understand all of this and how it would work. And they would have to be familiar with what the president's decisions were. And so even though the secession would carry through and say, okay, you know, the Department of Labor secretary is now the president, but the AI would say, well, here's what the president said he wanted to do or she wanted to do. Now that former Secretary of Labor, who is now the president, has another data point on how to make that decision, right? Okay, so the president thought about this. That's what he or she wanted to do. Maybe that's what I should do too. So just a little extra thought there as we think through.
Chris? You know, a couple of thoughts on this. You know, it's interesting, having spent some time in the White House in the Oval Office, again, the power of that place, it does make an impression on you. But I don't think any president, probably since maybe George H.W. Bush or maybe President Trump, really sat down and thought, you know, I may find myself in a nuclear exchange with a foreign power, mm-hmm. you know, probably with Russia. Starting in the early 90s, you know, George Bush and every president since, it just wasn't on anyone's That's mind. Right. They thought it was, you know, just so extraordinarily unlikely, and the world, you know, the world had evolved to where it was very unlikely at the time. You know, after the fall of the former Soviet Union, they were not going to attack us with nuclear weapons. China had no capability to attack us. Neither did North Korea, and the mullahs in Iran were, you know, a generation away from having that capability. And so it wasn't something they were, you know, that they were well versed in, and they didn't spend any time thinking about it. Now, every president receives a briefing when they're, you know, when they're sworn into office, and this is one of the first things they do. And again, for a generation, that's probably the first time they ever thought about it, and it's probably the last time that they thought about it. But that's just not true anymore. I mean, as I think we've discussed on this program, there was a time early in the war in Ukraine, where Vladimir Putin was beginning to lose his forces. He was getting pushed out of Kyiv. He was getting pushed back in the Donbass region. And I don't think it'll surprise many people to know he actually considered using tactical nuclear weapons. And once you've employed nuclear weapons on the battlefield, the whole world changes instantly in that moment. And it changes in a way that's very, very difficult for us to predict. Does it inevitably need to lead to a nuclear exchange between Russia and the United States? No, not necessarily. But it's a critical few moments of time, or a few hours, or maybe a few days, when the possibility that suddenly becomes very, very real. And so this president and the next president have got to be much more familiar with it than they are now. Now, if I were elected president, I mean, I would insist in the first day or two to not only receive that briefing, but to exercise it. I would want to play it out. Now, part of that's because my military background, we practiced and exercised all the time, right? Yep. Everything we did, we practiced. And we exercised it, because then in the heat of the moment, in the panic of the moment, you have that to rely on, and it calms you down, and you can think, and you hopefully make a good decision. I would hope every president does that. And then I want to come back to the points both of you have made, Curtis. I think you're the first one to make it. But again, the compression of time. Why would you put nuclear weapons on a hypersonic missile? It's not more accurate. It's not more powerful. The only reason you would do that is because it compresses the time, the ability of the United States to analyze the attack and respond appropriately. And I think they would hope to decapitate the leadership and make it so they couldn't respond at all. And once again, if we can use technology to uncompress that time or to give us more information more quickly, we clearly should do that. And then final thought, if I could, this idea of mutual assured destruction that has been the, you know, kind of the core of nuclear doctrine going back to the 1960s. And it's not just the United States. It's, you know, every world leader had nuclear weapons. The idea was that if these are ever employed, it will destroy both countries. And that just may not be true any longer. The precision, the compression of time, again, that we've talked about and other things, they really may lead our adversaries to think that they could strike first and not necessarily destroy themselves in the process. That changes the dynamics for us. And once again, we have to employ every technology we can and every strategy we can to make certain that they have the deterrence of knowing that there will be a response. And if that response is generated and facilitated, again, by artificial intelligence or new technology, that's good for us because it increases the deterrence.
Yeah, I tell you, Curtis and I, if we had our druthers, we would love to have you know, road mobile, rail mobile, ICBMs. So, and we would, I'd put ICBMs, I'd put some Sentinels in some C5s, I'd fly them around because, you know, you're creating a much stronger second strike capability. I would bury things, I would hearten things, I would disperse aircraft, I'd put, you know, the B-21 on alert. I would do all kinds of things to make America's secure second strike much more capable. Because right now, we don't have much of a secure second strike. And I have less confidence. I think by and large, the bomber force will be taken out, you know, early in a strike. I don't think we'll ever get a bomber off the ground if we're struck. And it's, you know, everybody says, oh, there will never be a surprise attack. We'll have this slow and gradual escalation. And my response is always, how is this idea of slow and gradual escalation that gives us lots and lots of time to act and prepare and put things on alert? That's inconsistent with history. When we've gone to war, the adversary has always engaged in a surprise attack to try to disable the United States or the allies in Europe. The nature is to try to strike first and strike hard and take your adversary out. And I don't know why a nuclear conflict would be any different than that. And so if an adversary did that with the capability and posture we have now, we would lose a significant portion of our nuclear force. And, you know, part of that would be the sub fleet. And, you know, submarines, there's this view that subs are so secure. You know, subs are really, really vulnerable as they're coming in and out of port. They're actually quite vulnerable. And so whatever you have at sea in a deep ocean box, assuming it wasn't followed out of port, is pretty secure. But we don't really have the kind of secure second strike that would be Curtis and I's preference. So therefore, what do you do? Well, we see this as an option to try to bolster the force and posture that we have to make it, you know, more secure and at least more scary for the adversary and more unpredictable, which is what we have to do.
Yeah, let me add to that. There's nothing necessarily provocative about increasing the survivability and of the second strike, right? Adding to the quote unquote guarantee, right, that Stephen Waltz talked about in his writings, the guaranteed second strike. How do you make that guarantee if you're not going to invest in the kinds of things that you need to do, not only in dispersing and protecting or hardening those capabilities, but also increasing those the mechanisms by which you would, you know, force direct, that you would employ the capability? Because if there's no risk to the adversary that you can actually, that you will actually do it and that you can actually do it, if they don't fear that, then your deterrence fails. And so I think that is key. And in a situation or in a climate where, in a geopolitical climate where everything we do is assumed to be provocative, even if we're reacting to what they're doing, but when they do it, it's okay. Then we have to do things internally that add to the credibility of what we have on hand, right? So if you're only going to have, right, so many guns, you need to make sure those guns shoot straight, that they're assigned to shooters who can actually aim a gun, and that they use ammunition, right, that works, right? Otherwise, your capacity is reduced even greater. That's why it's important that we have, spare parts for weapon systems and those sorts of things. And so anything that you can do to make your systems more survivable is key. I want to go to Chris's point real quick, though. Your question was, you know, what's the purpose of putting a nuclear weapon in a hypersonic weapon, a hypersonic glide vehicle? And that is, it is twofold, right? It is to hold us at risk in a coercive situation, right? It's to convince us or coerce us that we should not get engaged, whatever that might be, for fear of that first strike. They are first strike weapons. Those things are designed to be first strike weapons. And to Adam's point of this why do we think that will graduate into a war, into a nuclear war? To your point, right? German Blitzkrieg, Pearl Harbor, you know, these were all designed to strike hard, strike fast, and hopefully shock and awe in 2003 were all designed to, you know, sort of paralyze the enemy so that they can't decide what to do. And that's what we're trying to prevent, right? If you can't paralyze us because we have the technology that sort of works through that, all the better in that regard. And so we have to acknowledge that these weapon systems that are being built by the adversary are first strike capabilities. I believe that what the Pentagon has always believed over time is to be the least likely scenario, bolt out of the blue, massive laydown, in my mind is actually likely the more likely scenario. Why would a nuclear-armed adversary pinprick us with nukes and then think that we're not going to retaliate? Even with threats, their goal would be is you don't just poke at a bear, right? You're going to take that bear down if it's charging you, and their goal is to wipe us out, all of our capability that would for a counter force strike, and that retaliation. They want to wipe that out so that it doesn't in fact happen. So that's what we should be planning against first, and we should always be planning against the worst case scenario, no matter how likely it might be. If it is a worst case scenario, it is a possible scenario.
Chris?
You know, just one other thought. Adam, you talked about leaving us deaf, dumb, and blind. And Curtis, you just talked about, the swiftness and taking us by surprise. There's one other element to this that, you know, adds to that, and that is the expectation that in a nuclear exchange such as that, the very first missiles don't impact or detonate over the United States or our territories. They would detonate in space to create the EMP,
Absolutely. The
electromagnetic pulse that Absolutely. Does leave us utterly deaf and blind. And you know, imagine that where all communications is potentially cut off or at least severely degraded. Imagine the pressure of the policymakers and the military leaders trying to ascertain what is really going on, what's the right way to respond. Imagine the president in that scenario, who's not just going to be sitting with his feet up on the desk in the Oval Office. You know, he's going to be on the move. They're going to be an emergency evacuation to get him, you know, to Air Force One or to one other safe havens that they have available. So he's going to be making these decisions while he's literally running down the hallway with probably a dozen people trying to talk to him at the same time, every one of which he needs to talk to. He needs to know what they have to say while he's thinking about the safety of his own family, while he's thinking about the safety of 340 million Americans. I mean, it's unimaginable making us a decision in that kind of scenario. And again, if we can practice that, if we can prepare for that, and if we can allow technology to give us better information during that time, what a beautiful thing that would be. And if that technology includes artificial intelligence or machine learning, which can compress or decompress some of that time, that's helpful for us.
Chris, let me ask you, you were in Congress still, I think, last year at this time, when several congressmen, I think the Congressman Liu the Republican that just left Congress, Colorado, Buck, they co-sponsored a bill to ban AI in the nuclear command and control. I don't know that bill ever made it through Congress and got the light of day. I know we wrote an article arguing against it. Were you... I don't know. Did you engage at all in that? Yeah. Is that any comment on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, we were aware of it. And honestly, it was a good example of let's go set national strategy because we saw a scary movie.
Right.
I mean, it really was kind of like, well, you know, this is the way it's going to be. So honestly, that effort had very little traction. And I don't know anyone who's, you know, serious about working in national policy, a national security policy, a decision makers. I don't know anyone who supported it. I think most of them recognize this was kind of a clickbait message. It was not very well informed in my opinion. And it didn't ever take enough. And like I say, it didn't ever gain enough traction in Congress mm-hmm. to where we ever had to really counter it or try to dissuade people from supporting it. Cause I think most people viewed it as not a serious policy proposal.
Thankfully. And my fear it's going to get buried in some NDAA in the future and we'll wake up and discover it.
No, that never happens, Curtis. Nothing ever gets buried in NDAA.
You know, one of the things for the, you know, we'll have detractors from the arms control and disarmament community who call us warmongers and things like that. But, you know, for, let's suppose you're on the political left. Just think how much better this would be if Donald Trump, the man you hate more than anything, becomes the president. And you at least have people that sit down with him, walk him through scenarios, help him make good decisions so that this guy that you think is rash and emotional, you know, actually has to think through scenarios. That's a good thing, right? And now if you're on the political right and you think that Joe Biden is a dementia patient and that his wife is propping him up, then wouldn't it be good if Joe Biden had to sit down and walk through this scenario with advisors? And so regardless of which side you are on and which president you hate or which potential president you hate, this has the potential to help that president or any president make more informed decisions. And the idea that we don't want to, you know, we don't want to preconceive an, you know, a response, to me is a fundamentally ludicrous idea, because when do you not want to think through options ahead of time? I mean, I can't think of any case or any instance in which I said, you know what, in order to make the best decision possible, I'm going to make a snap decision under lots of pressure with time compression on top, because that's how I'll make my best decision. That's never happened. I don't know, Chris, maybe you do, but that's not how I make good decisions.
I think that's how I got married.
And, you know, one other just maybe final comment on this that I could make. And that is, in the Oval Office, if you're not wearing a military uniform, you are not prepared for this moment. Everyone in the national security staff and in the president's personal staff, everyone in the White House is going to turn to the military officers and say, what do we do? You know, what are the options before us? Again, wouldn't they rather have some idea what those are before? And, you know, for heaven's sakes, the military, to your point, Adam, we war game everything. There's hardly a scenario that we haven't envisioned and tried to, you know, kind of step our way through. Okay, if this happens, we'll do this. And then we'll do this. I just couldn't agree with you more that to include the very senior civilian leadership so that they have some idea other than just, well, I'm going to do what the generals tell me to do.
Because
that's all they're going to do right now is have the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff do whatever he says. Far better if they've thought this through and have some input to it before that moment.
And arguably the generals, they're going to say it's not our job to tell you what to do, sir. Exactly. It's only to give you the options. And so nobody makes a decision while we're all being blown to kingdom come, right? So that is the challenge. Adam, I'll just leave my final observations here with this, is that this article is meant to be thought-provoking and controversial. Well, I love both of those things. So this is my kind of article, and I just want to thank you for working with me on these things and working out these ideas. If we don't have these conversations, these hard conversations out in the open, then we're never going to solve any of these problems. And you know, we're spending billions of dollars modernizing the NC3 program, but we spend $0 trying to modernize the decision-making process, right? Fixing the decision maker. And how do we make that more efficient? That cannot continue to be the longest pole in the tent. And I think this is a way. It may not be the only way, but it is a way to get to use technology to get after this problem without creating all of the negative stereotype that we may be assigning to poor little old AI. Yeah.
All right. Curtis McGiffin, Chris Stewart, thanks for joining me on this episode of the NIDS View. And of course, I want to thank you, the listeners, for taking your time to listen with us. And of course, as always, I want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.